Okay, new music. Have the listener guess at what some of that is. Bit of a militant opening. Get the blood going a little bit. Hi, I'm Graeme Daniels. This is Getting Real About Sex Addiction, another podcast. In the series Getting Real About Sex Addiction, about a book entitled Getting Real About Sex Addiction, A Psychodynamic Approach to Treatment. And today, I'm going to talk by myself, about female sex addiction or women's infidelity. I'm going to explain, well, I'm not sure how much I'm going to explain the difference between those two concepts. I could be talking about something else, actually, like or the other kind of terms that are popular these days. PSBs, using that shorthand for the first time, problem sexual behaviors, as a stand-in for sexual acting out or sex addiction behaviors. PSBs, could that be referring to people as well? Could you refer to PSBs the way that you do refer to sex addicts? You know, we'll see. CSBD, compulsive sexual behavior disorder, referring to perhaps what might be the most common used diagnostic category these days relating to sex addiction. Because it's a diagnosis that exists within the World Health Organization's catalog and has been there for not very long, actually, only since 2017. Or you could refer to out-of-control sexual behaviors or whatever. You could think of, you know, addiction as, well, two main ways in which it gets talked about in diagnostic or assessment circles. One in which is, you know, akin to substance use disorders, meaning a discrete period of time in which you as an individual, suffering individual, afflicted individual, would exhibit symptoms, a syndrome for a period of 6 months or more and otherwise fit the criterion. You think about it from the point of view of, say, the 12-step community, and perhaps the medical community, if we're talking about, say, alcoholism, and some organizations like ASAM, the Addiction Society, or sorry, the American Society for Addiction Medicine, then they will think also of addiction in a broader way as something that is a part of personality or something you like akin to a brain disease. You know, one is hardwired towards addictive behaviors, something that's a part of you and therefore is to be monitored for the remainder of your life. Most people who become addicted to things aren't necessarily true addicts, as a doctor by the name of Lance Dodis, who wrote the book The Heart of Addiction, opines. You know, a true addict is one who will manifest some sort of addictive habit across contexts, which with respect to multiple agents. You know, if you're a sex addict, that means you are addicted to drugs, you're addicted to food, you can be addicted to a lot of different things. It's kind of a part of who you are. Now, in the whole realm of female sex addiction or love addiction, you're going to find those two terms get blended quite a lot. I've made some allusions to multiple books in this series, and there are books profiled in mine and Joe Farley's book, Getting Real About Sex Addiction, that are notable. Making Advances, a book by Marnie Ferre. It's about 10 years old, a little over 10 years old now. Erotic Intelligence by Alex Katahakis, also a little over a decade old. State of Affairs by Esther Perel. only the first book by Ferre, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing her name right, actually, is strictly a book about addiction. The other two, not necessarily, although there's a lot of allusion to infidelity and, you know, compulsive sexual behaviors in, you know, all of these kind of books. I'm going to be profiling somewhat today a book that is actually older than each of them, but it's only come across my radar recently, and it's probably my favorite of all of these so far, and I'm going to explain why. It's a book entitled Women's Infidelity, subtitled Living in Limbo. It's by Michelle Langley, and she has a lot of interesting things to say about the subject of women's infidelity, why women have affairs, a lot of what are probably controversial ideas. You know, just to touch on back, touch back to the idea of, you know, female sex addicts. And these are somewhat unicorns, I think, in the treatment field. First of all, it's long been sort of reported here and elsewhere that sex addiction treatment is obviously dominantly aimed at men. There's been authors who estimate that, you know, women comprise as little as 1 in 10 patients actually seeking and receiving so-called sex addiction treatment. And though there's some statistics about the prominence of symptoms that belie that kind of statistic, that's an interesting and an obvious disparity, you know, in the field. So it's hard to find female sex addicts, or at least find women who identify as sex addicts. And it's reflected here in something that I'm going to touch on, it, that the paucity of women on this very podcast. If you've been a listener for a long time, you'll have noticed that I've had only a handful of guests, some repeat participants like Joe Farley, the co-author of, you know, our book, of course, and, you know, three or four others have been on recently, but not many women. Actually, only two women have been on this podcast in the entire year and a half, little over a year and a half that it's been running. I want to say at this point, it's not without some effort to get women to participate on this. And the women that have participated have, you know, weighed in on some subjects, but not necessarily all of the subjects that I would want to address here and that I'm going to address a little bit well, coming up here. And Michelle Langley is one that I've been in touch with, and I might get her on to talk about her book and her writing in general about women's infidelity, because it's fascinating stuff. But I have to admit that it's been difficult to get women to participate in this. I think there's some women who I've reached out to, mostly female practitioners, either authors or, you know, fellow therapists who advertise, who indicate that they are, you know, working with either sex addicts or with impacted partners of sex addicts. I'm in particular interested in that. But they've been a little shy to come on board. Who knows? Maybe they've listened and they don't want to disagree with me. Who knows? Michelle Langley is not someone who probably would disagree with a lot of what I'd say, but we'd get into some interesting discussions anyway. I'm going to get into why I like her book. She, among other things, does not hold back in the way that I find that a lot of authors do when talking about either women's sex addiction or infidelity. There's an air of carefulness that I find that is interesting, that undoubtedly relates to the stigmas that have been aimed at women historically about their sexuality, which I do not deny. I just think it takes interesting directions in a sort of post-feminist era. And by post-feminist, I'm really talking about the second wave of feminism that begins around the end of the 1960s, going into the 1970s. We're a good 50 years beyond that now. And I think culture is quite different than what many people suppose. Michelle doesn't hold back on a lot of her views. And what is most, I think, intriguing and perhaps compatible with my way of thinking is that she suggests a lot of unconscious process, at least in society, in its observation of men and women's sexuality. And in particular, challenges men's denial about women's sexuality as well, which I think in itself is not one of the more controversial views. But here's some of the things that she writes that perhaps are controversial, depending on, you know, where you stand. She challenges the notion that women are monogamous in nature. She goes further to say that women are just as inclined towards infidelity or promiscuity as men, and are only not that way because of social restrictions, meaning it is because of the stigmas aimed at women's sexuality that women might appear to be more libidinally restrained than men. she offers something else that I think is undeniable, that historically, you know, men have sought to control women's sexuality, and asserts that this is grounded in men's insecurity about paternity. And this is interesting. I mean, I don't think this is a unique to her. There's others who have offered these points of view, of course. There's something about the directness of Michelle's approach that I think maybe what would be controversial, but I find refreshing. a central thesis here also touches upon a motif. I'm not sure that's the right word I'm looking for in psychoanalysis. It's because Michelle's theory here is based in what's called phylogenetics. It's the idea that individuals have inherited species-driven motivations that are unconscious. Now, the most notable and famous examples in psychoanalysis are those that relate to social taboos, most notably incest and cannibalism. You know, we do a lot of talking about in psychoanalytic or its subset psychodynamic treatment about how people have various levels of consciousness about how they're motivated by past events. But we generally think of that in terms of people's individual histories, how they were raised by their parents, maybe the cultural milieu in which they were raised. And we may attach to that ideas of a so-called social unconscious, which is, you know, relevant as well. A broader sort of influences that impact a person's upbringing. But largely we think of that in individualistic terms. We tend not to consider, unless we think about it, that, of course, our revulsion towards the things like incest and cannibalism are not based upon our individual histories. This is born of that which is far back in the prehistory of human beings. And it has to do with this notion, sometimes deemed abstract, but it's applicable here, that Sigmund Freud introduced, that the unconscious is timeless. The unconscious does not care about the passage of time. Now, why is that significant? Because it doesn't matter that some of our anxieties, which are, in our unconscious, that they are outdated. You know, this is the notion that change is slow. Why is this relevant? Because the fear of paternity, for example, is outdated because in scientific rational terms, today in the 21st and indeed in the last century, we could prove paternity through paternity testing. Science has caught up. But still, what Michelle asserts is grounded in the unconscious of man and his desire to control the sexuality of women, his lack of knowledge about whether or not he is the father of the children that will, you know, be born because of sexual activity. Okay, that's one of the ideas. into this sort of backdrop, Michelle drops a piece of data that I might have guessed was true, but I didn't think about this particularly until reading this in her book. It's a piece of data, and she makes pronouncements that women initiate 70 to 75% of divorces. Now, just a reminder that this is based upon a book that's now close to 20 years old. So, you know, whether or not that is still true today, I'm not sure as of giving this podcast. And she further suggests that many of these women who are initiating divorces are doing so because they are having affairs. And that men don't notice that these women are having affairs because, I think this is sort of a cultural idea that they are clueless, and that this probably would be attributed to kind of masculine narcissism that the culture delights in observing. Or secondarily, that men, like many women, are sort of bought into false notions of feminine virtue, which are also, you know, oppressive. This is an example of something that I point to quite a bit in Getting Real about Sex Addiction, that those who practice in the field, I think, exhibit quite a bit of circular reasoning. You know, society, Michelle echoes this idea as well, finds a way to blame, you know, men for phenomena, no matter what the phenomena or data is. This is a function, Michelle Langley asserts, of how women have been socialized towards victimization, which lends itself, of course, to, you know, blaming men for phenomena, hence being unhappy in marriages and wanting to get divorces. Women, she asserts, don't like to take responsibility. That's probably one of the example of a phrase that's it probably would be controversial, and if any man asserted that, they'd simply be branded as a misogynist and, you know, end of discussion, I guess. We don't, but it touches on an idea that unconsciously we tend not to assign responsibility to groups we identify as underdogs. This is a function of power and privilege. It's a corollary of power that you also take the blame or responsibility. We love to blame politicians, for example. Why? Because we assign to them power. So how do Michelle's ideas fit in the modern world of psychotherapy, you might wonder? You know, particularly in its formats of, you know, couples therapy, or, you know, treatment for infidelity, or treatment for so-called sex addiction, or again, problem sexual behaviors, or CSBD, all these now, you know, preferred, you know, designations, or variable designations. A lot of these treatment regimens, you know, strategies, plans, etc., they have tacit premises. Premises that, for example, that society is patriarchal. This is a contemporary one. You wouldn't have, you know, heard much chatter about this 50 plus years ago, but you would be, particularly in recent years. So society is patriarchal. Psychotherapy is counterculture. Why is it counterculture? Because, one thing, 70% of its workforce is female. And it wasn't that way all along, but it's certainly become steadily towards that, again, in the last 50 years. And something that I indicated in the book Getting Real about Sex Addiction, popular psychology literature, its consumer base. I read one study and cited one study that indicated that 84% of the readership for popular psychology is female. So women are the consumer base of psychotherapy. So it's, I've argued that its messages have to be aimed at them. And one of the things I think this results in is that women, female practitioners, female therapists, female psychologists, etc., they tend to subscribe to the view, again, I don't think it's argued in too many quarters, that women are stigmatized for their sexual behavior more than men are, both currently and historically, or especially historically. That women feel a particular pressure to be a, quote, good girl, sort of tending to a sort of childlike past, I guess, and that what goes along with that is a tendency to want to cater to man's potential to split the feminine image, what Sigmund Freud called and what I profiled as the Madonna whore complex, you know, two or three podcasts ago, you know, that tendency to find difficulty in integrating the qualities of nurturing and, you know, sensuality in women. So the tendency to split them into profiles of Madonna and whore. But back to the notion of what, you know, female practitioners tend to subscribe to, rather than offering that women are as libidinally driven as men, as, you know, Michelle Langley offers, you know, that idea that women would be as likely to engage in infidelity or promiscuity, but for the social restrictions placed upon them. Most women practitioners I find or read of, they tend to patronize a kind of an idea of feminine virtue that can sometimes seem even chauvinistic, that isn't necessarily feminist, but rather reflective of traditional biases. And to kind of support this, I'm going to read something that was from one of the books I indicated earlier. It's a passage actually from Getting Real About Sex Addiction, but I'm quoting a passage from Erotic Intelligence. It's a book by Alex Katahakis. And the passage reads as follows. Males and females are attracted to different qualities in one another. When a man sees a beautiful woman, his emotions ride high and his logic disappears. In contrast, females are attracted to a companion who can provide and protect. Thus, when a woman sees an attractive man, she wants to know how he thinks and acts, and eventually how he will care for her. Women have larger limbic centers than men. These are emotional networks in the brain that orient women towards caretaking roles like child-rearing. Men with high testosterone are more likely to get divorced and have extramarital affairs. Men with low testosterone levels are calmer and less aggressive, making them more likely to get married and stay married. Katahakis, 2010. I go on to comment, actually, about this, and having read some research that's contested, I think, some of that kind of populist rhetoric. In picking apart the views of gender study luminaries like John Gray, Luann Brizendine, Steven Pinker, and Simon Baron Cohen, Cordelia Fine, 2010, by the way, that's a feminist author of a book called Delusions of Gender, which I also recommend, outlined flawed research practices and debunked much of the science proclaimed innate differences between male and female brains, including differences relating to empathy responses. Also, and I cite here a study group led by Elliot, 2015, found differences between male and female brains to be minimal. This is only 5 years after the Katahakis book. Including differences within the hippocampus, which is within the limbic system, which is responsible for memory and emotional responsiveness. The hippocampus had previously been reported as being larger in women than in men, justifying gender stereotypes like, quote, women are more in touch with their feelings. In a meta-analysis of 76 previous studies, involving more than 6,000 subjects, this study found that the female hippocampus is not significantly larger. Second, the study found that differences in brain size have no discernible bearing on intelligence or any other specific faculty. That's relevant because men's brains are actually a little bit bigger than women's. Anyway, third, the study also reported that, contrary to another popular myth, the size of the corpus callosum, a bundle of nerves that connect two sides of the brain, allowing them to communicate, does not vary according to gender. This is important because we think these myths are still being shared with consumers of psychotherapy, enabling the belief that women possess a superior capacity for empathy or that men are more logical. This in turn inclines clinicians to believe that female sex addicts relate more to the concept of love addiction because sex is not just a biological drive, but something that sustains an all-consuming relationship. And again, Women like Michelle Langley, who reminds us that women hit sexual peaks later and have hormonal changes that go into effect later in life than those of the sexual peaks assigned to men. Men, it's in late adolescence, around the age of 18. Women, it's in their early 30s. So, this is kind of some of the language and some of the research that is contesting some long-held stereotypes that I would argue that have informed or misinformed psychotherapy for two, arguably three generations. That women's brains are different. You'd read a lot of that. That women are, quote, more relational, which is sort of a euphemism for empathy. That women are less objectifying. This is based upon a rather singular definition of what that concept is. That women are more restrained, more, quote, loving, more, quote, caretaking, more, if you like, mature. And the result has been a schism in the treatment of sexual problems or problem sexual behaviors or sex addiction, men towards sex addiction, women towards love addiction. For women, it's a matter of preserving, I would argue, this idea of a feminine ego, and also protecting them from the stigma that would otherwise be aimed at them should they be exposed in their problem sexual behaviors. You know, the literature regarding female sex addiction, there's much less attention paid to their behavior, much less their inner process. Regarding men and sex addiction, the ideas or presuppositions about their inclinations toward the behavior becomes a pretext for really a secondary area of treatment, which is the a kind of systemic critique of masculine ego, and particularly around the assignment of narcissistic traits. I read in a lot of literature, particularly that which is aimed at female sex addiction, the cautionary notes that authors make about, you know, not assigning personality disorders to individuals, be surprising because of the amount of how often you hear of narcissism being fairly readily assigned to male sex addicts. You know, we have to contend with certain cliches that the male is only interested in one thing, namely sex, that is sort of easy to caricature as selfish or arrogant, as privileged. And another corollary to this, and one that was, it's hard to say who made this sort of popular or widely utilized. I'm thinking of Claudia Black, who wrote a book in 2009 called Deceived. It's about impacted partners of sex addicts, and it's clearly aimed at women. Anyway, she has a chapter entitled His Behavior Is Not About You. And it's the kind of thing that I'd like to talk about with somebody who would represent impacted partners at some point, because I think a lot of impacted partners, people who are, or what are sometimes called betrayed partners, when they think about entering treatment or getting support, they express skepticism about the whole sex addiction concept, mostly because they think at the outset of treatment that it's enabling a leniency. You know, it's letting the unfaithful person off the hook. They think addiction is, quote, an excuse. What they find in chestnut phrases like, you know, his behavior is not about you, which is, you know, offered by supportive individuals, is a fault-reducing message that becomes not only quite welcoming, I would suggest at some point rather seductive, because it renders the blame quite unilateral in what might become an ongoing way. Anyway, that's for perhaps another time. But, you know, part of the point here is that we wouldn't be aiming the kind of messages that I just talked about with respect to male sex addicts. It's unlikely we'd be aiming them at female PSBs or sex addicts. you know, much less on behalf of male impacted partners, partly because they, for one thing, barely exist. You'd be hard-pressed to find support groups or literature. Well, you might find literature aimed at impacted husbands, actually, but it'd be difficult to find therapeutic services, particularly support groups, that are aimed at impacted partners that are male-oriented, where you'd find plenty of impacted partner support groups that are aimed at women. So, you know, because the support groups for impacted women, they're like a faction within sex addiction treatment, and their voice, you know, carries some influence, of course. The narrative around women and their problem sexual behaviors is that if they are having affairs or they are having problem sexual behaviors, it's because they are unhappy in their relationships, unhappy in their marriages, et cetera. It's not because they are just hardwired towards, you know, being sexually driven, as is commonly assigned to male sex addicts. They, again, are deemed relational. And there's an irony in actually a lot of this, because if we think about some of the most popular literature relating to sex addiction, even that which was, I won't say originally, because I think a lot of it is, as I've often argued here, derivative of psychoanalytic literature. But the original popular literature, like from the 1980s, Patrick Carnes' Out of the Shadows, his 1991 book, Don't Call It Love, you know, offers a view that again is derived from Freud that suggests that addiction has sort of two poles to it. Sex addiction has two poles in particular. One is about pleasure and stimulation seeking, that we only want one thing idea. But the other pole of addiction is this idea of pain avoidance, the escapist purpose of addiction, which implies something relational, actually, because what is it that generates distress? Something relational generates distress, ultimately relational. And that what Carnes likely believed in some of his literature, or what he suggests in his literature, is, although he won't have called it a displacement, that sex addiction behaviors are substitutive. that a, you know, sex addict thinks his, I'll go with the pronoun for the time being, his most important need is sex. This is an ironic statement. It's the idea that his most important needs are, say, his attachment needs, you know, his needs for nurturing, his needs for companionship, his needs for tenderness. You know, man is as relational as women are as libidinal as men, might be the idea that we could arrive at. And start to believe that men and women are not as different as we think, but for, you know, the assumptions we insist on having about one another. And that addiction is indeed about pleasure seeking, but it's also about pain avoidance. I hopefully will soon have, you know, a female, you know, practitioner, someone, or somebody on behalf of impacted partner to discuss some of these issues with, because I think they are necessary if sex addiction treatment or problem sexual behavior treatment is to overcome what I think is the biggest elephant in the room, the obvious disparity between who is getting treated, what gender is getting treated, and what is not. So that's it for this particular episode. My name is Graeme Daniels. This is Getting Real About Sex Addiction. Check out the book, Getting Real About Sex Addiction by Graeme Daniels and Joseph Farley, A Psychodynamic Approach to Treatment. Thanks once again for listening.